We continue the shiur on the topic of Rabbeinu Zal. The topic we're up to now is the continuation of the story of Rav Nosson Zal's trip to Eretz Yisrael. An adventurous trip which resembled the trip by Rabbeinu Zal. That's why we've had this story immediately following Rabbeinu Zal's journey to Eretz Yisrael too. Before we continue the story though, it is only fitting that since we had a couple of weeks intermission due to a trip that we made to the direction of Rabbeinu Zal Seir and Eretz Yisrael, it'd be fitting to give a brief report on that trip. Something which is very pertinent to everyone here, everyone interested in being zechet to get to Rabbeinu Zal Seir. First and foremost, if a person has the proper emunah, they would know. But if you were asked what is the most important achievement a person can attain in life, the most important, without any exception whatsoever, the answer is definitely to get to Rabbeinu Zal Seir. Nothing is more important in life, because this affects a person's entire past. Entire past means for as many thousands of years as he has been present on this earth. It affects a person's entire future, meaning infinitely in the future. Nothing else can have that deep an effect upon a person's neshama, which is everlasting. Now, therefore, the most important venture, attempt a person is to strive for is to get to the tzion. There is an additional point of information which we want to discuss now in reference to our attempt made. Our meeting, myself and two boys, Bob and Stan, who were with me, together, of course, with 11 others from Eretz Yisrael and from Canada. Now, this attempt was made to the best of our ability. No one will deny that. There was a lot of expense involved, as is supposed to be in case of a major mitzvah. The Zayin HaKodesh says that a mitzvah is great if it is be'agar shlim. There's a lot of money and expense involved in it. The mitzvah has much greater value. A person should not seek out a mitzvah which is free, which is costless. Mitzvah is important if it costs. That's why the mitzvah of Esrog is one of the most beautiful mitzvahs out, because Jews spend money, they seem to squander a lot of money on that mitzvah. So in this case then, it was a very expensive trip, and I can testify to the fact that of all the trips ever made to Uman from America, this was the most expensive one yet. In addition, there was a lot of other sacrifices were made by all parties involved, parties meaning a total of 14 people who attempted to get to the Tzion. Getting to the Tzion involves the trip from here, off of Eretz Yisrael, first to Moscow, and then from Moscow a trip to Kiev, which is a good few hundred miles. It's an overnight trip by train, or an hour and a half by fast jet. And then from Kiev to Uman is the final leg of the journey. It's only about 120 miles, only because that's the shortest leg of the trip, but that is the main one. In this case, we succeeded going from America to Moscow, which means, literally, traveling to Rabbeinu Zal Seir and getting approximately 5,000 miles closer than we are in America. We were 5,000 miles closer to Rabbeinu Zal Seir when we were in Moscow. Moscow to Kiev, direct line towards Uman, again a few hundred miles closer. When we got to Kiev, there we were stopped. We could not get further than Kiev for a number of reasons. The result was, we'll come back to this more in detail, but the result was that from Kiev we had to turn around and go back to Moscow and thence there to New York, which would appear to most people that this trip was a failure, chas v'shalom. There was no success in getting to the Rabbeinu Zal Seir. What is the difference whether you travel from here to Kennedy Airport and are stopped there, you travel from here to Kiev and are stopped there if you don't get to the Tzion. The answer is there's a vast amount of difference. We once explained, we said this many times, Rabbeinu Zal's Havtocha, Rabbeinu Zal's promise for those who get to the Tzion was, if you get to the Tzion, if you say the Tzion means to be standing at the grave itself, you say the 10 chapters of Tillim, the Tikkun HaKlali, you give Stucca, and then Rabbeinu Zal said, I promise, this was actually a promise, with two top witnesses who were there at the time signed to this vow. I will take that person out of Gehenna and will save that person forever afterwards. Out of Gehenna, of course, means not just from Gehenna after he dies. A person living on this earth, walking the streets, could be living in a spiritual Gehenna while alive. That too, basically, will save that person from. Will elevate that person to a new level in Kedusha and holiness. Now, Rabbeinu Zal also said, we had this case we mentioned many times of a person who was not a follower of Rabbeinu Zal. He was not actually a Rabbeinu Zal student. He was friendly to Rabbeinu Zal students. In that, he provided them with bread, a simple commodity, necessity of life, but a very cheap one, bread. And one time this baker died, and he apparently had difficulty up in the heavenly court, and his soul came to Rabbeinu Zal, appeared before him, as did many thousands and thousands of others, as it told the story, who came to plead with Rabbeinu Zal to help him in the heavenly court. Rabbeinu Zal inquired of his students what this person had done. They said this person had helped the students by giving them bread at a cheaper price, a lower price, so they can have bread challahs for Shabbos. Rabbeinu Zal said, because you have helped my students, therefore, in turn, I will help you in your trial before the heavenly tribunal. That's a very vital lesson, because we see that Rabbeinu Zal will help a person who does the slightest thing for his students. Kolshek is surely so, one who does something for the sake of Rabbeinu Zal himself, one who strives to get to Rabbeinu Zal himself. As was pointed out too, Rabbeinu Zal once said to one of the two witnesses to this vow, to this promise. One of them was known as Rab Aaron Zalbi Breslov. Rab Aaron Zal, the dove of the city of Breslov, whom Rabbeinu Zal liked very much. Rabbeinu Zal told him that when Mashiach comes, he will bring Mashiach to Rabbeinu Zal, will present Mashiach to Rabbeinu Zal. That's how much he liked him. In addition, he said that when you come to Gan Eden, and I bless you, you will understand the lightest, the simplest statements that I made while on earth. That's how deep the Rabbeinu Zal's statements are. Which means that the Rabbeinu Zal's hasaga, his understanding, his depth, was just about infinite compared to any other mortal. Yet the Rabbeinu Zal himself said, having achieved so much mentally, spiritually, Rabbeinu Zal himself said that he wishes that he himself could achieve to understand, to evaluate properly the light, the immense heavenly light that emanates from the steps that a person makes in his journey to Rabbeinu Zal, to Rabbeinu Zal Tzion. Steps means every inch, every foot of the way. Every mile, every 1,000 miles, this is multiplied. This Rabbeinu Zal wished himself to be able to achieve that point of seeing the great light that comes from the steps of these people who make their journey to Rabbeinu Zal. In that case, then, we surely cannot belittle, chas v'shalom, the value of a person traveling to Rabbeinu Zal Tzion, covering 100 miles, 1,000 miles, 5,000 miles. Especially too, the Gemara says that if a person attempts to complete a mitzvah, to perform any mitzvah in the Torah, and due to an accident, which is beyond his control, he failed to fulfill that mitzvah, the Gemara says that the Torah itself accepts that person's actions, his efforts, as though ke'ilo asor, as though he completely fulfilled that mitzvah. So a person tries his best, he bends his every effort, much as he can do. For example, in this case, going to the Menes Alcyon, spending all the money that was necessary without figuring any limits, going to Moscow, getting to Moscow without getting cold feet, without being filled with fright and fear because of an incident that occurred there. We came to Moscow. We didn't go through customs as simply as previously. This was a very exceptional case. Not only did they examine the baggage and attempt to confiscate all these sfarim that were brought in, they also took one of us in to a special interrogation room. That one was one who was accustomed to this interrogation room. It was myself. I'd been there before, but never for this period of time. This was done by the head of the secret police of Russia. In that interrogation room for a period of 3 hours, 2.5 hours alone, a very solid, serious grilling, very strong interrogation, with a lot of threats and so on, as usual in those cases. This wasn't an afternoon or an evening spent pleasant conversation, as they call it, conversation. It was not pleasant conversation. This was a very unpleasant ordeal. And after that ordeal, with threats hanging over our heads further, a lot of these threats, we continued on our journey to Kiev. We came to Kiev that night. A heavy snowfall descended upon the city, and it seemed obvious that it would be impossible physically to travel from there to Uman during our stay. Plus, the fact that they themselves said, the Russian authorities said, in no way will they allow permission to travel from Kiev to Uman. This meant that we had reached the final point of our ability. We had used up every last amount of energy or resources that we possessed to get to Uman. The rest was a heavenly move. Heavenly move because we did not control the weather. We did not make it snow. Nor did we control the hearts of the authorities. When the authorities want, they extend a welcome mat. First time we went to Uman, about 12 years ago, we were received with royal honors by the mayor of the city of Uman, by the authorities, and given a most cordial welcome. Now, what made them so bitter now and so warm then? This dictator says, Lev Melech Miyad Hashem. The hearts of kings are in the hands of Hashem. Hashem injects a certain feeling of acceptance or rejection on their part. So this was not within our power. This meant that we had used up every ounce of effort possible. We had done as much as we possibly could, which is known as Anshiyot HaMagas, as far as we could physically perform. The rest was a ethereal, a heavenly move, not under our control, and therefore, this is what the Tatum says, a person does everything he can, and due to an accident beyond his control, he does not fulfill the mitzvah. The Tanya declares it as though he fulfilled the mitzvah completely. Abinazal on that statement says that a person should never be satisfied with this statement. Never be happy with the fact that Tanya says as though you fulfilled it. You don't accept the as though. You want the actual fulfillment. True. So in that case, we added to all our efforts the desire. We want the actual fulfillment. Nobody can deny that. Despite this, our desire was not enough to effect a sort of miracle and get there. Which means, though, we cannot, chas v'sholem, belittle the statement of the Gemara. The Gemara does say, and the Gemara means the word of Hashem, that if you tried to the best of your ability, you did not succeed, the Tanya accepts it as though you did succeed. And of course, Rabbeinu Zal surely will accept that Gemara too. He'll surely accept the efforts of those who tried so hard to get there. If they did not succeed physically, and surely it is as much or much more than the baker did for the students of Rabbeinu Zal. So surely Rabbeinu Zal will accept the act of these 14 who tried so hard to get to Rabbeinu Zal's Siyun. We are certain that this is a priceless venture. Again, too, if we could not get to the final inch, the last bit of land covered, which means right in Kiev itself, so we had to start going back. We then said the Tikkun HaKlali as though we were standing by the Beit HaZasin. Let us say, imagining that there was a crowd of a million people standing before the Beit HaZasin, and this covered an area of 100 miles. So we were at the end of that crowd, the middle of it. We couldn't get that close. We said the Tikkun HaKlali then with the same fervor, the same feeling as though we had gotten there. Again, we say we believe with implicit faith that the trip was a successful one, enough to a degree. In fact, to sort of prove this, every one of the 14 people was asked the same question. Since you did not get to the scene itself, surely you suffered a shivere lev, the sort of a heartbroken feeling. Now, a suffering, the sacrifice, the money that was expended, all this yesurim, all this suffering that you had, is worth a lot. Zayin HaKodesh says there's nothing more precious in heaven than yesurim, because a person suffering forgives for sins much more than does Yom Kippur or Tshuva. So all this suffering you had for the sake of the Beit HaZasin, it cost you a certain X amount of dollars. How much money would you take, would you sell the mitzvah of this yesurim for? How much would you take for it? And everyone replied with the same answer. I would not take $1 million or any amount. I would not sell that for any amount, just as I would not sell a trip to the Beit HaZasin if I had succeeded. This then proves definitely that we are happy to say that the trip was a success. But also in that, it whetted our appetite to the desire to attempt once more. We will not stop. We'll attempt once more, again and again, to get to the Beit HaZasin. And if we get there, we won't stop either. We'll try to get there again and again. And of course, the hope is extended for every single one here, for everyone who wants to get to the Beit HaZasin, that he should be successful, he, she, should be successful in achieving this completion of this mission. Because to get to the Beit HaZasin is the highest accomplishment one can ever hope for. We should all be zecha to get there with ease, without suffering, without yesurim, get to the Beit HaZasin and fulfill the necessity to receive the Beit HaZasin's avtocha, his vow, that we can truly be considered closely attached to the Beit HaZasin. Now we continue the story of Abnasazal's trip to Eretz Yisrael. And again, we must pause for a second, because just a couple of brief words, the fact that from Kiev to Moscow to Switzerland, sort of globetrotters, from there, we could not get to the Beit HaZasin, we did get to Tzion, to Yerushalayim. From there straight to Yerushalayim, and they're carrying a banner of the same names, those of the group, to Yerushalayim, to the Mekaymes HaKdashim, to all the holy places in Eretz Yisrael. As is known, Reb Shimon Yehoi Zal is the closest one to the Beit HaZal. The Gematria is the same, the Beit HaZal's name, Gematria, Reb Shimon Yehoi Zal, to get to meet on. Ashrei HaNeisim Al Tzionecha, Ashrei to those who were zecha to get to the Beit HaZasin. And of course, by proxy, you did get there by having your name mentioned there in tefillah for you, to the tzion of the Ari HaKodesh, the Rizal, and of course to the Meoras HaMachpelah, the cave of four couples, or the Mechava, the cave of the fathers and mothers of the Jews, the cave of David HaMelech, the Melchi Beis Yehuda, Beis David, and the Kesel Maravi, and of course, Rabbi Kochav Lev Zal Sion. Have your names mentioned there? Rabbi Kochav Lev Zal, the tzaddik, the holiest tzaddik of our time, who is, as you know, the official Rebbe of this group. Ashreinu for that, because he is our strongest binding tie to Rabbeinu Zal. Then, of course, in the yeshiva itself, the Elazar's yeshiva, the Misha Melech was made on Shabbos, mentioning all these names too. So we hope that surely this trip was very successful, above all successful in that a tefillah should bring fruit. Everything that each person wants or needs should be fulfilled. Yimale Hashem, kol mish'aleis libeinu l'teva. All our needs should be fulfilled by Hashem in a manner of simcha, sasim v'simcha, shiduchim, zivugim hagunim, panasa b'shefa. And of course, too, to go back just for a moment, if I may, during the trip itself, it wasn't a waste of time, because we did spend time in the hotels in Moscow and Kiev, there learning. We had a very pleasant time on Shabbos. You can call that pleasantly spending Shabbos there with a minyan, davening and learning, and we even had a little shir. In fact, one of the interesting sidelights of the trip was that we ate, the three of us, Mommy and Stan and myself, I came to their room, and we had our Shabbos meals there, Friday night, Shabbos morning, and Shabbos Shalashudas, Shudim each time. And I can see that they were very efficient in every respect. In fact, one thing stood out in my memory. The one time, during a meal, Stan went to wash out a glass. Went to the sink in the room to wash a glass. And of course, his very deft, agile fingers were such that he dropped the glass and broke it. And Bobby, standing there, looked at him, and very peeved, and said, "I told you not to mess around in my kitchen." I'm sure his wife will enjoy that one. But it was a truly abreast of a trip, journey that was memorable. Again, I say it should be repeated with complete success very shortly from now. Well, a trip that is historic, Rav Nosazal's trip then to Israel. The story we got to was when Rav Nosazal got to the city of Odessa. And there he was attempting to get a ship, a journey from Odessa to Istanbul, Turkey. And then the last leg of the journey going from Europe to Asia, to Africa. But in Odessa, as we stated the last year, there were many who tried to dissuade Rav Nosazal from making this journey. They told him that it was very dangerous. There was a war going on between the Turks and the Greeks at that time. Traveling by boat, by ship on sea, was so perilous that there would be a very slight chance of making the journey successfully without being killed en route. Rav Nosazal was disheartened by these talks. He looked for his chaskus, strengthening elsewhere. And he decided that, come what may, he would make this journey, regardless of what perils there are, because remember that the Benazal made this trip during the wartime too, during the Napoleonic War, the French-Turkish War. And if there is that much of a desire, then certainly Hashem will help that it will be a successful journey. So he went and he rented a cabin on board a ship. This, of course, was a ship of Goyim, completely Goyish ship. He rented a cabin, stateroom for two people, himself and his colleague, Abiud Eliezer. And he waited for the time that he'd be summoned to enter the ship. The ship stayed in port many days before it set sail. While there, he heard about two messengers, two Talmidei Chachamim from the city of Vilna, which means that they were students, followers of the famous Vilna Goyim. It means, of course, too, they were called Misnagdim. They were opposed to Hasidim. But these two were going to Eretz Yisrael to raise money. He wanted to speak to them to sort of receive some encouragement about going to Eretz Yisrael, because he knew they would make the journey. So he visited them, and a very strong debate ensued. A very serious argument. The discussion led to the topic Emunas Chachamim, Emunas Sadikim. have emuna in a tzaddik emes. Rav Nosazal argued with them, and their contention was, just as today, how do you define a misnagid? Misnagid is mesnagid. When it was dead, who has no life, spiritual life, negid against what? Against chassidim, against something which is life. Chassid is chas, bigmatria chayim, life. Yudalad stands for David HaMelech, chayim v'kayim. These misnagdim are against anything which is true. Emes. And what is the actual difference? The difference is emunas tzaddikim. They do not possess the faith that chassidim have in their Rebbe, no matter who the Rebbe is. At least they have emunah in a tzaddik. So the Masazal debated this point with them, and it became a very heated argument. They asked them, if you don't believe in a tzaddik emes, then tell me, how do you define the word emunas chachamim, faith in a tzaddik? They said, of course, we hate to repeat this statement because it is very prevalent today too. You ever get into one of these controversies, forums between Hasidim and Misnagdim, they said, how can you believe in a person? You have to believe in Hashem. And Chas V'Shalom, of course, that is close to Kfida, close to atheism, because Satanus states definitely, again and again, that you must have Emunah Tzaddikim as well as Emunah Hashem. The Zayin HaKadosh goes into that very strongly, as, for example, in one case, the Zayin HaKadosh says that Hashem is the king over the Goyim, who rules over all the nations. So one of the Apikorsim once asked this question to one of the Tanoim, that means that Hashem rules over the Goyim. What about the Jews? He doesn't rule over the Jews, they rule over him. How is that possible? And the reply was, it is true. Hashem is king. He rules completely over the Goyim. As far as the Tzaddikim, of course, Hashem says, I control rain. When I want it rains, when I want it, it does not rain. And then along came Eliyahu HaNavi, he said, I will stop the rain. He took over the power of rain. Hashem says, in my hands are the power of life or death. When I put a person to death, he stays dead. And along came Eliyahu HaNavi, he said, he stays dead until I say he goes back to life. We see that Hashem rules over the Goyim, but there is a Tzaddik Emes who can kaviyachol rule over Hashem. And this is the basic tenet of our faith. A Jew must have faith in the Tzaddik Emes as well as Hashem. You cannot separate the two. Emina b'Hashem of Mesha Avdei. There must be Mun in Hashem and the Tzaddik Emes simultaneously. These two misnagdim tried to actually eject Rav Nosazal physically from the room, but the Balach Sanya, the landlord, made peace between them. Rav Nosazal left and said, wrote, Ashreinu, how fortunate we are that at least we have this Emunah Tzaddikim, and how fortunate we are not to have a part among of these Misnagdim, because here are Misnagdim who claim to follow also a tzaddik, the Vilna Goyen, and they don't even have emunah in the Vilna Goyen himself, to say that he's that great as a tzaddik emes. Of course, again, the Blessed Zohar writes that a Jew can be a true Jew, a true Yisrael, a true Eved Hashem, only if he has emunah in the tzaddik emes, only if he's truly mekusha, attached to the tzaddik emes. There are many tzaddikim mitiyim. Of course, there we have the problem, how to get to the tzaddik emes. But until a person reaches the tzaddik emes, at least the person should have iskashus, a tie, and faith in all tzaddikim, till he's enlightened to which one is the tzaddik emes. But if he has faith in all tzaddikim, then surely he's also attached to the tzaddik emes at the same time. There is nothing actually lost then. Ashrei to those who are zecher to zecher, to go through life and get to the realization of the Beit Hazal as the Tzaddik Emes. Many people have to go through another life again till they finally get to this point. So those who have gotten to that realization should be very careful to hold on to it, because it's very easy to drop. The Beit Hazal's words are that this world is a Geshe Tzad. This world is a very narrow bridge, very narrow. And a person walking along this bridge can easily slip and fall off, as we see the infinite number of casualties in each generation. People who had faith and they dropped, chas v'shalom. Many things mean not to have any fear, to be strong, courageous in the face of all the opposition. Because if you go out in the street, in the world, you'll find that the average person, the majority of people, will scoff, will sneer at you for having this kind of emunah. To remain solidly strong, the Bein Elul says, throughout life, to maintain that courage and that emunah when Mashiach comes, or if a person passes away first, he will then see immediately in the Elam HaEmes, the world of truth, the true beauty of the truth itself at Tzadik Emes. This, Ibn Elul said, was his consolation, having spoken to these Mishalachim from Vilna, how fortunate he was not to be part of them. After Pesach, Ibn Elul came to the port, and he had already gotten this room for two reserved in a certain ship. He had to get to that ship to bring his belongings there, his baggage. So he went along the port, the port where all these ships are docked, and he tried to ask instructions, information, how to get to this ship. But all the sailors there were either Italians or Turks. There was no way to converse with them. So he kept on asking for the captain of that ship. The captain's name was Yakov Tadvayevich. Apparently some kind of a Russian name. Yakov Tadvayevich. Abnasazar writes this in his diary. And because of the fact that every detail of this trip was so important. He asked about this captain, and one of the sailors pointed out the ship to him, and he showed him how to get to that ship. In fact, the sailor led him towards that ship. Well, this was a port, and the dock had a lot of ships lined up side by side. In order to get to a certain ship, you had to cross the decks of all these ships to go from one to the other. To go from one ship to the next, you had to travel over a slight bridge, a plank from one ship to the next, or to go up and down. Not all ships were the same height. They had to go through ladders, or even at times to climb a rope up and down. Abnasazar wasn't an athlete, but he writes that his desire, his fervent desire, so it was so great that he followed this sailor, this weather-worn sailor, who had apparently years of experience at sea. He followed him as agilely and as expertly as though he'd been a sailor himself all these years. He helped his friend along too, till they got to this ship. When they got there, this was the end of Shabbos Kodesh, and he was shown their cabin. He had a little difficulty with the captain first. We can't go into the details. You can read that yourself in the story. Of course, a misunderstanding about the price. And Abnasazar was afraid the captain might ask him for more money than he had, which means he wouldn't be able to travel. He had a lot of aggravation over that. He just writes one point that it turned out okay, just that in trying to negotiate the deal with this captain, he had very much difficulty with the language, because he writes that he didn't understand Russian too well himself, though he was brought up in Russia. The captain, too, couldn't speak Russian too well, so they both spoke Russian. And he said this was like two amenatzim, two illiterates trying to argue about a certain pilpul in Gemara. Well, each one doesn't understand what the second one is saying because they don't understand what themselves are saying. So this was a very unclear type of conversation. And finally he succeeded in getting his room set, established place for himself. Then he had to go back with a sailor to bring his baggage from the port to the dock back to the boat. He finally had this accomplished, and this was done before Shabbos Kodesh. Then they set about in their room to make a fire to cook a chicken to cover Shabbos. Abnasazar writes about how the boat did not leave until after Shabbos, yet they had to stay on board before Shabbos to be Kodesh Shvisa, to be allowed to travel if it would leave on Shabbos. They spent the Shabbos in this cabin. And how they did it with such simcha, it's reminiscent of a room in a Moscow hotel. where we spent Shabbos. It was a closed cabin. There they had to cook their own chicken, and they made their own meal. They sang Zmitas, made Kiddush, they ate the meal. This was done Friday night. They davened the regular Shabbos davening together. Same thing Shabbos morning when they davened, and they read the parasha of the Torah. They ate their Shabbos meal. Then they went out on deck to observe the type of the nature of the workings of a ship, a large ship. Vessels of Rice, they spent a few hours. This is unusual. You must take everything seriously to observe very carefully. Vessel spent a few hours watching the wondrous movements, labor, in setting up the sails of a large ship. There was no motor then. And how the sailors worked so feverishly getting these sails put up, and how much work is involved, the marvels and wonders of a large ship, how this ship could travel the seas and the oceans. Thus is all spoke about it as seeing the wonders of Hashem. In each generation, how there are things done that defy nature. How can a ship dare to set out on an ocean voyage against storms, winds that might take it other than its course? And of course, as is mentioned by Moshe Shtamino, later Talmidim, that Hashem, Nelson himself writes, that Hashem conducts the world most wondrously. In each generation, Hashem adds something to the world. We find new inventions, new innovations. This generation is so far ahead of the past generations. Rabbeinu warns about that, not to think at all that we are wiser or more advanced mentally than the past generations. On the contrary, they were much smarter than we are. They did not invent, they did not discover electricity or any other of the inventions we have now, not because they weren't as smart as we were, because the date had not yet been established in heaven. And Hashem wanted that date to come. He would place the knowledge of electricity even in the mind of a dummy like Franklin, whoever it was, because that time had come. So Hashem put it in the minds of a certain individual on earth, and suddenly, lo and behold, he became a genius. He discovered something that's so important. Or the motor or so, or the other types of innovations that came into being. So this Reb Nosselzal observed very closely to see the wonders of Hashem, how these wonders are applied in each generation to improve the lot, the standard of living. They spent a few hours there, and afterwards they davened mincha. They hoped to leave then, but there wasn't a strong enough wind, so they stayed over until after Shabbos. While there, the captain offered Reb Nosselzal tobacco, smoke. Nosselzal declined the offer. The captain said to Nosselzal, very suspiciously, "Of course, I presume you have a lot of money. And of course, you're Jewish. You're very miserly. You have a lot of money. That's why, because you don't smoke. You try to save on everything. Therefore, you have a lot of money." Nosselzal was afraid that he might think they're wealthy. Perhaps he might even try to kill them for their money. So he said to this captain, with a very sincere tone of voice, "The truth is that we do not smoke, not because we are miserly, we're simply very poor, and we have no means of achieving wealth." This was accepted by the captain, so now he realized they were poor. He gave them more food than he had intended to at first. They accepted everything with simcha, with happiness. Nosselzal said he was zechut to find peace of mind on that ship. On Monday, the ship set sail on Sunday, and the first day, Nosselzal writes that he was surprised he'd not become seasick, because it's normal for a person going for the first time on board a ship to become seasick. The first day he wasn't, he thought he would have mastered this already. But on Monday, he became very ill, together with his chaver, and until they weren't able to eat at all. At night, this lasted during the entire day. At night, they slept very little, and on Tuesday, they felt a little better. they heard the captain and some of the crew playing instruments and sort of a semi-orchestra there, a band playing instruments, music, and they heard that some of the crew were dancing. These, of course, were all Goyim, doing dances, Goyish dances on board the ship. The Nossos all came out together from Yudavaza. They watched them dance, and slowly they joined these Goyim in the dance. They went into the center of the circle, they danced themselves. The others stopped to watch. When you see the Hasidim dance, it's more spectacular and more intriguing than a Hadol any other type, because this is done with spirit. The Bezal brings lead by Nosas Raglov. The heart is put into it, and the heart just elevates the feet so that you actually dance on air, the heart carrying the feet. You got to stop to watch Abnosazal and his partner dancing so well. And two sailors who were drunk jumped into the circle, and they too started to dance. Very happy, very joyous dance. Nosazal said that he watched that and said to himself, "How wonderful we are, Ashrenu." And here we have them dancing, the Goyim, happy with what? They don't know what happiness means, with what to be happy. And we are happy because we're on our way to achieve the greatest possible schus, to get that it yourself. So he said, "Let them dance and we'll dance." Each one with different thoughts in mind. Of course, this went on for a while. Nosazal thought too that it was a bigness, a miracle he had witnessed, were among all Goyim. Those days, Goyim were Goyim, like, well, of course, today too. Today we have the United Nations who are all Goyim. And Goyim means one who hates or despises a Jew, to an extent. In many cases, it means to the extent where he'd like to get rid of the Jew completely, Chas V'Shalom. Here then, they had Goyim who were all against the Jews, who looked down at the Jews, though they themselves, these Goyim, were complete illiterates, were worthless creatures, yet they looked down at Jews. So in the midst of all this whole crew of Goyim, unless that the Nosazal and his partner could dance openly, go into such a holy rikud right under the stars of the sky. Nosazal wrote about this with great simcha. He was zecher to dance on his ship headed for Istanbul. On Erev Shabbos Kodesh, they reached Istanbul. It was Friday, but they got there too late to leave the ship. They had to stay over Shabbos on board the ship. On Sunday, they entered the city and they got to an Achsanya, a hotel. They recognized some Jews from Europe, and these Jews spoke to Abnosazal very, very strict, severe, stern tone of voice, telling him that it was foolish, it was folly to come this far. But there was no way, no possible means of getting to Eretz Yisrael. He should turn around quickly and go back home, because it is impossible under any conditions to get to Eretz Yisrael. Of course, this caused him a great deal of heartbreak. He turned away, he went into a corner, he began to pour his heart out, began to cry before Hashem, and then he felt a little better. He went back, and somehow he met a woman who was traveling from Istanbul to Odessa, going back. A woman, a Jewish woman. And he got into conversation with her somehow. And she said to Abnosazal, "Don't listen to these foolish men. Because I tell you, I just came from Eretz Yisrael. There may be some risk in traveling, but it's nothing. If you want to get there, so you certainly can do it. There's no problem whatsoever. If I could do it, you could surely do it. Anybody tries to talk you out of it, just ignore that person completely. I tell you that it definitely could be done." Nosazal wrote about this. This encouraged him very much. And of course, it's noteworthy again and again to note that sometimes a woman has more courage than a man. You find that in case of childbirth, they're better off. But the type of courage in doing a mitzvah, we find often when it comes to mitzvah, a woman has a greater strength of purpose, strength of heart in carrying this out. And here, Nosazal felt so dejected, he got to a point that was Chas V'Shalom close to Yish, not actually giving up hope, but close to it. He was very brokenhearted. Here, a woman came along and raised his hopes, raised his spirits to the point that he felt now for certain that nothing could stop him anymore. he would definitely carry out the rest of the journey successfully. His problem, though, now was how to spend the next few weeks in Istanbul before going on the next leg of the journey from Istanbul to either one or two ports, the next stop, either to Alexandria in Egypt or to Beirut in Lebanon. That was the next, either one of those two. He had to decide between these two. Meanwhile, to stay in the city of Istanbul, which was a very strange type of city, as we'll see in the next chapter. It is important to note, though, that this was the same city where Abinazal II spent time before his trip to Haifa. We'll continue this the next shiur. And again, we point out the most important moral of this story. Nussel's words, that the Yesod, the foundation of a Jew in life, the foundation of a Jew's future forever, is emunah, is faith. Faith in Hashem, faith in the Tanakh.